Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Hey folks, we have a website that's powered by Squarespace, which has made life easier for us since we started using it more than a decade ago. With Squarespace's collection of cutting-edge design tools, anyone can build a bespoke online presence that perfectly fits their brand or business. Squarespace gives you everything you need to offer services on your site and get paid. Plus, streamline your workflow with built-in appointment scheduling and email marketing tools. Check out squarespace.com/WTF for a free trial and then use offer code WTF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/WTF, offer code WTF. Okay? All right, you got it? All right, let's do the show.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How's it going, man? Women? Those? What's happening? Every day is 2 days at least. I go through the full arc of all the emotions on any given day. Some for longer than others. Most of it self-generated reactions to things that my brain makes up. But it's a full day. A lot of busy work, a lot of adjusting to this new time that I have in the sense of being off the road, out of the publicity mill, and just kind of locking in for the long haul before I start shooting stick. But I'm all right. Are you? I guess. Been going up at the store trying to get some new shit going. It's amazing how I give myself no real break to kind of not rest on my laurels, but just kind of regroup. I just don't do it. I just get up there out of habit. And some of it's coming along. To what end? I don't know. A lot of stuff going on in my mind on a lot of levels. All right? My brain, when overloaded and full of panic and fear, will, in terms of the world that we live in, my brain wants to just sort of bring that down to me. How can I make my little world equally as terrifying so I can feel like I have a little control over it? And there's a word for that. I think my psychiatrist said obsessional anxiety with a focus. I added that part. It has a central focus on only bad things. Anxiety is never a good feeling. Someone sent me an email that said, maybe you should frame your anxiety as excitement. Well, that would mean I'm excited about the worst things happening possible. And I guess I could do that. I don't know how that would change my personality. I don't know. I don't know, folks. A lot going on. And as you get older, the first thing you realize in terms of this, as you hit a certain age, that your parents can't help you anymore. If they're like mine, they really can't help because they just, they're just who they are. But they're there. But you do realize at some point that it's on you. You got to help yourself. And then in the world we live in now, you're like, wow, no one's going to help at any level. That's a lot to manage when you've got the unresolved parent shit going on. And on top of that, the sort of the world of politics and government and police and everything else is sort of like, will anyone come to help after a certain point? Will they? Look, don't want to be weird. Don't want to be scary. Ben Stiller is on the show. He was actually the first really big star to come to the garage in the first months of the podcast. It was episode 79, and it was a big deal for us at the time. Obviously, he's continued to act, write, and direct since then, including his work behind the camera for Severance. Season 2 is nominated for Outstanding Drama Series at the Emmys, and Ben is nominated for Outstanding Directing. He's here. Nice to catch up with Ben. We're all becoming old men. Me and Ben, a few things that I should tell you about. I will be hosting a screening of McCabe and Mrs. Miller at the American Cinematheque at the Aero Theater. That'll be on Saturday, 8/24 at the Aero Theater, 7:30, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. I'll chime in a bit about it at the beginning, but it'll be nice to see a nice print of that, won't it? You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for a link to that. I'll be at Largo doing a show with a couple of other comics on the 28th of this month. Again, you can go to WTF Pod for a link to that. That's on Thursday, the 28th. And then hopefully this link will be up as well. I'm going to do a show with the band at Largo on September 10th. And we've got some good songs. We're going to start working on them. That's the whole idea of working with this new crew is to rehearse. And we got plans, man. We're going to do Guilty by Randy Newman, I hope. We're going to do Jumping at Shadows. The old Fleetwood Mac version, and stunning songs, those two, heavy. We're going to do Can't Put Your Arm Around a Memory, Johnny Thunders. Again, a little heavy. And maybe George Jones, Say It Ain't You. So there's a lot of self-reflecting and sadness in this list. And we'll do a couple of happy ones, maybe Heaven by Talking Heads. That's the plan. We'll see how that unfolds. Oh, before I forget, if there's anything you wanted to ask me, now's your chance. We'll be doing our final Ask Mark Anything bonus episodes. So send in your questions. Just go to the link in the episode description of today's show and send me whatever you want to ask. Then subscribe to The Full Marin to get the final Ask Mark Anything bonus episodes as they roll out in a few weeks. Okay? I think I walked you through the toe problem. And I just didn't believe the doctor. And then I went to another doctor, and he confirmed the first doctor's feelings that it wasn't anything I should worry about. And you give me a week or so, and I won't believe that doctor either. You know why? Because I want to be afraid. That is where I'm comfortable. Full of self-flagellation, fear, shame, panic. Yeah, that's my family of origin groundwork, folks. That's my self-parenting skills. You fuck. But there's some light in the midst of all this. I don't know. It's so funny, man. Sometimes these comedy shows that I do, I did Tripoli show last week. They're sponsored by weed companies. So there's guys in the back from the weed company, and they got weed. Like all kinds of, I've talked about this before, but I don't think I really put it together until Kit pointed it out to me how funny it was, because I don't smoke. Obviously, I haven't smoked in a long time. I just had, 26 years sober. But I was thinking back on it, I used to smoke, man. And back in the day, I had a roommate who sold weed. And so there was weed everywhere. And just the daily weed practice. I need to get into a meditation practice, and I'm in the point with a lot of this advice I'm getting, I'm almost doing it. I'm in the I'm planning on doing it stage of doing things that are helpful to my mental well-being. Almost doing it. I can stay there for a while. But back in the day, the weed was everywhere. And again, the daily practice of weed smoking and knowing there was weed in the house and knowing that the guy, across the hall had the weed most of the time. It was just a part of my life for a long time, weed, before, but it was illegal. And I remember one time in college, the dealer asked me to go across town and pick up the weed from the main guy. And it was like a pound of weed in my memory. And it was terrifying because I had to walk about a couple miles and with a backpack and pick up the weed. And, I was breaking the law, right? Walking down the street with a pound of weed on my body. But it was pretty fucking exciting. And the only reason I did it was for weed. That thrill of, just being transport and it took me a lot to muster up the will to do it and then to sort of figure out how I would get out of it if I got caught. Hey, it's not mine. It's for my friend. That one. That always works. But I guess the thrill of pulling it off and then getting a bag of weed because of it was, I was a fucking outlaw, man. This fucking outlaw. And I think that part of this whole thing with, getting legal weed for Kit and then putting it in a bag and putting it in my car, that she pointed out to me that, you know, you're fucking old school and you're an old timer and you're an old man. There was a time where that was pretty thrilling. And I think that's probably true. It's just sort of like, look at all this weed. Back in the day, this would have cost a fortune. I'm just going to put it in my car. And then you're driving with this weed in the car and you're like, I don't even have to worry about it. So the thrill is gone, but there is some phantom limb there that gets reactivated when that stuff happens. So look, Ben Stiller is here. Severance is streaming on Apple TV Plus. He has Emmy nominations this year for Outstanding Drama Series and Outstanding Directing for a Drama Series. And this is me talking to Ben.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
So I haven't seen you in a long time.
I know.
It's been 15 years ago. 15 years.
Since we did this?
Since we did this at the old house.
That's fucking crazy.
Isn't that crazy, dude? 15 years.
I was thinking about it.
You're like one of the early guests.
I was thinking like maybe it was like 7 years ago.
No. Well, that's what happens. You enter this time zone of a certain age, which I guess we're at. Where, like, the things behind you compressed into, like, what was that, last year?
Yeah.
No, dude, it was 10 years ago. No. And I don't know, I never feel like time is flying by and when I'm in it.
Right.
But now when you hit this certain age, you're like, what the fuck? Now it didn't fly by, but it's gone.
Yes. It's really weird. And
yeah.
It's such a strange thing. Like, when you're in the moment, you're in the moment.
Yeah.
But then I look at like friends that I have and people that and have watching my kids.
Yeah.
My daughter's 23.
Jesus. Well, that's a nice reality check with kids. Cause sometimes when you don't see a friend for a few years and then you see them and you're like, holy fuck.
Right.
Dude, I got to go look at myself. Am I not? If you look like
everybody around me is aging horribly.
Right.
I don't change at all.
No, of course not. Not you. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've noticed and I've talked about on stage that the relationship we have with our mirror is not right.
Yeah.
Because you see pictures of yourself and you're like, oh, fuck. What's happening? But you look
I don't
good.
Understand. No. But it's really depressing because I look in the mirror.
Yeah. And you're like, and I'm holding on.
No, kind of.
Oh.
But then there are. Or moments where I'm like, who the fuck? Like, whoa.
I know.
And then I think about my dad, like, saying to me when he was older, I look at myself and I don't recognize who this person is. Because inside, he's still like 30.
Yeah. Sorry.
And I'm that guy.
Yeah. Sorry about your dad.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, it's been a while, right? It's been 5 years.
Yeah.
He was the best. And he lived to almost 93.
93.
Yeah.
And he had all his wits about him?
Not all the way through.
Yeah.
But he was, he was always there though.
Yeah.
But the last couple of years were tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause my dad's 86 and it's all going away.
Yeah.
And when you say 93, I'm like, oh, Jesus, I hope it doesn't
go. No, it's a real thing. And, you know, my dad's sister is still alive, his younger sister. And of the four siblings my dad, his sister Doreen, his sister Maxine, and his brother Arnie, she's the one who's still alive. She's 90. Now she's 94.
Yeah, it's a classic list of Jewish names.
Like yes.
It. Arnie.
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 My uncle Arnie.
Arnie, of course.
He had a lighting fixture company in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, good. Yeah.
Yeah, he did well for himself. He got out of Brooklyn. He moved to Chicago, became a traveling salesman.
Oh, yeah.
And married his high school sweetheart and did well.
My grandpa Jack had a hardware store and an appliance store.
Oh, wow.
Did all right.
Okay.
Drove a big caddy.
Yeah.
In the hills of New Jersey.
Yeah.
He did all right, those guys who sold things.
No, my dad's brother was sort of like the guy who he moved out to L.A. and he moved to Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Before my dad even was, you know, successful. And my dad and mom never moved out there.
Well, they never came out here?
My mother hated L.A.
So they were always in New York?
Yes. I mean, there was a period of time when they came out here to work in the 70s, and we'd come out with them, and I loved it.
To be on all the shows?
Yes. Yeah. To do, like, Courtship of Eddie's Father.
Oh, yeah. Did they do, like, Merv Griffin and stuff?
They did Merv Griffin. They did, Hollywood Squares.
Mike Douglas.
Yeah, Mike Douglas. But Mike Douglas, you'd go to Philadelphia to do.
Oh, it's Philly.
He did it in Philly, and we'd all take a limousine down to Philadelphia.
That's the best.
Yeah, it was so exciting. For me, I loved coming out here, but my mother never drove.
Yeah.
Hated it out here. So they would come out when they had to work.
Yeah.
Later on, they'd stay at the Chateau Marmont, and my dad would do King of Queens, you know, Seinfeld at King of Queens, and my mom would stay at the Chateau with him.
Yeah.
And she'd take a cab to the Grove
and
go hang out and then just be there with Jerry. And it was really sweet. I mean, they hung out together a lot.
That's so nice. Yeah. I met your mom once at some panel or something. I don't remember, but, you know, she was.
Yeah. I mean, she was a tough broad.
A little scary.
Yeah. I've been working on this documentary about them for the last 5 years. Yeah.
5 years.
Yeah. And it's finally finished and it's going to be coming out in October.
On what?
On Apple. It's an Apple original film.
Oh, good.
It'll be on the Apple service and also in theaters too.
Did you dig up all the old footage?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So there's a lot of Mike Douglas. There's a lot of Merv Griffin.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Barbara Walters doing a show. Barbara Walters did a Sunday morning show called Not for Women Only.
Yeah.
Where they would, like, have people in a studio and they talk about issues. So my parents are talking about a lot of real stuff
in
their relationship.
Did you learn anything?
Yeah. Yeah.
Things you didn't know about?
Well, I mean, my dad also recorded a lot of their conversations. He recorded us a lot.
Like Nixon?
Kind of. Well, he would do a rehearsal. Like, they'd rehearse they'd improvise on their sketches. They'd tape it, and then he'd keep the tape going.
Oh,
so I have some arguments that they had.
Oh, those.
And discussions about, like, my mom's drinking.
Really?
And stuff like that. Yes, it's all in the documentary.
Was it triggering?
I mean, how could it not be?
I know. You know? But were there moments where you're just like, oh, my God.
I mean, I still have those moments because I look at this thing and I'm like, it's kind of weird. Like, sometimes I don't know if it's totally healthy because I'm like, I go back and I'm like spending time with my parents.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like it actually feels good.
Right. But it's the first time you're detached from it.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
You're in a safe space.
Right. And also it's in a movie that I've made.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in a way, like, I can control.
Oh, that's good. I'll show them. What if I put this here?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's kind of great, too, because I feel like I did learn stuff about them. And I see them in a different context because I really do feel like I kind of understand a little bit more about how tough their work dynamic could be because they were tied to working together as a comedy team. And it was like it was just all within the space of our apartment where they would have one room that they'd work in. After a while, they got an office on 57th Street. But a lot of it was just happening sort of like, you know, it was all like overlapping with our lives.
Well, it's a weird thing when you – like, if you have difficult parents, no matter what they do, that to separate the bad things that you have in you of them from the good things, like how to manage, like, all right, well, this is not a great thing I've inherited from this person. How do I keep that under, or like, how do I manage that and embrace the other thing as opposed to just be pissed off?
Yeah. And also, I think when you're younger, there's a stuff that you rebel against. You say, I'm definitely not doing that.
Sure.
I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
And then for me in life, life has gone on and I've made those mistakes and I've I've done those things and I see it from another perspective too, having kids and seeing how, like, my attitude towards my kids who, you know, both are wanting to, my daughter's an actress, my son's going studying. It's like, you know, my parents must've been thinking when I was doing it, those protective feelings, the concerns, all that stuff.
Is there any part of you that's sort of like, don't do show business?
Sure.
It's like, you know, I got lucky, I got talent, I made it, but most people don't.
Well, I think that's how my dad felt about me going into it.
Yeah.
But as soon as he saw that I was serious about really, like, I was just going to do it, he was supportive and then protective.
Yeah.
My mother was a little bit more at arm's length with it. I don't know how to explain it. She was not that she wasn't supportive. She just was a tougher audience, you know? So the bar was a little bit higher. And by the way, I actually sort of feel like I have a similar sensibility to my mother comedically than my father, more similar than my
really?
Father. Yeah. Like, yeah, in terms of like the stuff that my mother, like my mother would like love Spinal Tap.
Right.
Yeah, my dad, I think, would appreciate Spinal Tap, but not
quite
really.
Get it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because he's broader.
Yeah. He was from like the Eddie Cantor generation.
Yeah, sort of like, I don't get it.
Yeah. I mean, he would enjoy it. He wasn't like tough on things like that.
Right.
But my mother really loved like the nuance of those like show business humor and
Well, I mean, I just watched, what was it, Day Trippers, where she played that?
Yeah, she's great.
She's so good in that.
Yeah, she was a good actress.
No, she's great.
Yeah, and she's in Fame, the movie Fame.
Oh, yeah.
She plays the mean English teacher. Yeah.
But when she was like it's already a problem when you have a mom that's like, not necessarily judgmental, but slightly diminishing, you know, just in terms of whatever that is in their being that does that. But to perform for your mother and to not get the laugh or something, it must be like, that must really kind of give you some chops of some kind.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I don't ever remember like really like performing for her.
No, you're not bouncing bits off her?
No. Mm-hmm. It was more like kind of when I went out in the world and started acting and doing my stuff, what she responded to.
Oh, yeah. You know? But when she didn't respond, what did she say? Like, I don't...
It was never like a direct
like,
thing.
Like, I don't get it. What are
it
you doing?
It was just more like I remember when... Yeah, no. She'd be like, oh, yeah, that was good. That was good. Did you see, like, when I was making, this is like, I had a great close relationship with my mother, especially as she got older.
Yeah.
But she, like when I was making Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
That's a big one.
Argo had just come out. And she was like obsessed with Argo. And she's like, oh, do you see Argo? I was like, yeah, it's really good. She's like, oh, it's so good. Yeah. Argo, fuck yourself.
Yeah.
Argo, I'm like, yeah. I'm like, mom, did you check out my movie? I mean, it was a subtle thing.
No, it's
but what, it would like, it would just be like, oh, why can't.
It's the worst.
Yeah.
Like before I had any visibility, my dad would say things like, hey, why don't you, maybe you call Bill Maher. Maybe he can help you out.
Exactly. Right.
No matter what you do.
Right.
No matter what you do. Yeah. And Walter Mitty was a huge movie.
Yeah. Or she'd be like, why don't you do a movie with the Coen brothers? I mean, I would happily if they called me.
It's never enough.
Yeah.
What did she like that you did?
She liked the stuff I did with Noah Baumbach, like Greenberg. She really, Permanent Midnight, she liked a lot. You know,
the Meyerowitz stories I just rewatched.
Yeah.
That's such a fucking great movie.
Yeah, it's a good movie. Yeah.
He's
great. Noah's great. And Adam's great in it. So good.
It's crazy. And Dustin Hoffman's great.
Yeah.
And just the end of that movie where they go into the basement and they dig out that box.
I know.
It's the fucking best.
Yeah. No, it's very moving.
Oh, my God. So I have to tell you, I was watching the Academy Awards, and I talked to you about this 15 years ago.
15 years ago.
But it was a different bit. But it's so funny that the way I'm wired to receive, you is like when Conan says, brought you up, that Ben Stiller was going to present. I was like, here we go. Now we're going to get a laugh. I don't know what he's going to do.
Oh, the pressure. The
expectation. It was so funny, though. It literally paid off. It's satisfying.
I'm very happy that it worked. It worked out.
I don't know how you...
Those things are so surreal.
But I don't know how you do that. Like, because I mean, outside of whether you want to hear it or not, I think you're like one of the best physical comedians ever.
Wow.
And but it's so natural because it's not something that I have. If I'm going to do a physical bit, I got to work on it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that you can just do it. Like the end of my last special, I mean, I had to orchestrate this thing and figure out the beats, but you got to do that, right?
Right. Yeah, sure. I mean, those are all like technical things where like...
How'd you get the timing? You had to trust a guy?
Yeah, we went through it in rehearsal and I just basically said, I've learned what the parameters of the elevator thing were.
Right.
And then I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't too easy. It was like, and in rehearsal, it was too hard.
Too easy to what?
Too easy to get up. Like when the thing started going down and I like finally got up at the end and I wanted to make sure that it wasn't too easy so it didn't look like fake or something.
Right.
But in rehearsal, they made it too hard and I literally couldn't get up to do it. And people were laughing. I was like, no, this isn't funny. I literally can't get up there. But it would be funny if I could almost do it and then finally get up there. So it was just like trying to figure out the right height of, and then I had like did that thing where I was jumping up and down.
Yeah.
And so I realized I needed a mini tramp. So they slid a mini tramp in there for me. So that was the thing I was most stressed about, was that I'd miss on the mini tramp and, like, you know, fall and not come back up. Yeah. And then I just wanted to get the words out.
Right.
That was the other thing. Because you just, on those things, you just don't want to, you just don't want to screw up the words.
Right.
You want to just, like, have it go smooth. Because, like, one little flub kind of just, because it's so short, it just throws off the whole thing.
Yeah, and it's remembered.
And then, it was just like, can I just get the words out? Will I be able to read the teleprompter without my glasses? And is the height of the elevator thing right? And then it just becomes like, all right, like, right that moment before you do it.
Yeah.
And the thing, the guy puts the elevator down, you're just here like, why am I doing this? What is my life about? Why do this is, doesn't even matter? Of course, it doesn't matter. Yeah, whatever. Whatever happens, happens. This is just, these are just human beings sitting in a room.
And then it's and calming yourself down.
Well, just sort of like, and like, didn't I do this like 20 years ago? Like, have I not progressed any further in my career?
Well, that's definitely not true. But because, like, the timing of it.
No. Like, I give myself credit for recognizing when they pitched me a couple of ideas that I was like, okay, that idea seems like it's funny and simple.
Because
it was so simple that I thought, okay, this is just an execution.
But it had to time out right. Like, you had to come up and then it had to stop.
Right.
And then
then you're also at the mercy of the technical people. Right. So you just have to trust them that they're going to do what you did in rehearsal.
Right, right.
And thankfully, they were great and they did it.
Oh, it's so fucking funny.
And then you're just so happy when it's over.
Yeah.
So happy when it's over.
If it lands, it landed good.
No, when it lands, it's great. It's great. And you come off and you're just so happy and you see people with their Oscars and then you're like, oh, they have an Oscar and I did a bit.
But it's not nothing.
And the person with the Oscar is like, oh my God, you're so funny. You're so funny. I'm like, thanks.
Congrats. Yeah. I got to go. You haven't gotten an Oscar yet?
Not yet, no.
Oh, God damn it. It's just killing you, huh?
You know, at this point, when you hit this point in your life,
I've won nothing.
You have to look at what are your goals? Because, you know, do you want to spend your last 20 years worrying about the stuff that, you know, you haven't gotten?
But isn't that weird, though? It's like, it's not even like worrying about it because, like, for some reason, my timing with, I'll blame timing.
Yeah.
Like, I've gotten no prizes. And... I got one for podcasting that was important within our medium.
Right, right.
But there's still this thing where, and I don't do as much as you in the big time show business, but you can spend your whole life saying it doesn't matter.
Right.
Like, you know, you're doing the work, but it so fucking matters.
It matters in that people, you know, it's an acknowledgement and it's an ego thing that we all would love.
Yes,
right?
The ego thing.
Right. But it's also, I think it's a very real thing that if you focus on that, I mean, that's like, you know, Tropic Thunder, whatever. It's like actors like getting obsessed with, you know, you can't do it. It's not something you can focus on going like, I want that prize, so I'm going to do this work.
That's where you purged it. Yeah, I know.
It doesn't work at all.
Well, no, you can't. You can do the best work you can and then think it deserves an award.
Right. But then also, of course, there's also like all of the machinations that go behind that.
Well, that's
and everything.
The thing.
Yes.
It's not like based on some, you know, system of merit.
Right, right. But then I look at like Daniel Day-Lewis. I'm like, yeah, of course.
But usually it's just based on, you know, our peers or the hundreds of people who we don't know in show business, you know, going through a site going like, I didn't see that, but I like him.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And the campaigning and what people, you know, which, you know, it was funny. I was talking to Seth Rogen last night and we were talking about having a TV show and all of the Emmy campaigning stuff and all that stuff that happens. Right.
Yeah.
And when you have a successful show, stuff that you were not aware of, or us both having done movies for a lot of years going like, I never knew there was like this American Film Institute top 10 movies and shows luncheon that's been going on for like 30 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we were never invited to. It's like all of a sudden, like now your show is getting recognized. Oh, wait, there's this thing. And we've been doing the, you know, Spielberg. Yeah, I've been doing these things for years.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, this is just something that was not on my calendar. Yeah. No one
told you.
It's not like anybody tells you like, oh, this is happening, but you don't have to do it. It's just it happens and nobody.
And no one wants you to be there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, well, I realized that too about the Directors Guild. You know, like, it's a very... when I talk to directors, they all kind of know each other because it's a relatively small community.
Yeah.
Like those, like the Directors Guild is not 10,000 people.
Right. Right.
There's like, what, a few hundred of you?
I think, I'm not sure how many, but it's definitely smaller than like the Academy.
Yeah,
you know,
sure. Or, yeah. But it feels like a kind of a unified bunch somehow.
Yeah. And also, I mean, honestly, the Directors Guild Awards and those things, like those are the things that are like, as when it's your peers, you know, those are the things you really appreciate
because
it's people that you really appreciate.
Sure.
So even to be able to like hang out with those guys or to go to one of those events and talk with other directors for me is always the most enjoyable.
It's the best, right?
Yeah. Because I really, you know, I really love movies and to be able to talk to, like yesterday, I also got to talk to Rob Reiner because they were doing something for Spinal Tap too.
Yeah, yeah.
And we did an interview.
Did he say this? Trump, right?
Yeah. bring Trump up. Yeah. He didn't, to his credit. He didn't bring Trump
He's
up.
He's so funny,
yeah.
dude.
But I also got to like say to him, like I sort of like got to fanboy to him because like this guy's made some, like more than a lot of incredible movies.
Oh, yeah,
You know?
Oh, yeah.
And it's just sort of that appreciation for me, like even as a kid growing up, watching movies, even when my folks were in the business, I kind of nerd out because I
like,
love
didn't he do, he did The Princess Bride?
Yeah.
And didn't he do Stand By Me?
Yeah, and he did A Few Good Men, and he did Spinal Tap. I mean, he did Misery. It's like the guy has had a run. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he's a really good director and different genres and—
And you know what's great about him is, like, there's no affectation. He's just a loud Jew.
Yeah.
You know, that like, you can come right down to him and he's like, what? You
know, but he's so funny, like, as an actor,
so funny.
Meathead.
The best.
Meathead is, right? He was like, come on, arch.
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
But then in Spinal Tap, he's the best straight man.
The best.
He just he sets them up, asks them the questions. They're improvising.
Yeah.
He knows how to just not react or react.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I really appreciate that.
Did you watch the doc with him and Albert?
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
It's a very managed situation, but it was funny.
But you know what? I'm glad somebody is, you know, giving Albert Brooks the flowers.
It took me so long to get him. You know, I had him on. You know, but he made me go, you know, he didn't want to come here.
Okay.
I don't know why. He didn't want me to come to his house. So
where'd you do it?
He got a room at that old deco like kind of hotel on Santa Monica, the Georgia or something.
Okay.
I can't remember. It's a beautiful place. But he's like, meet me here, we'll do it there. And that's where it happened.
Was it fun?
It was great.
Yeah.
It was great.
Oh,
he's the best.
I just watched the other day the Albert Brooks School of Comedy.
Oh yeah.
The
short SNL one.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's like one of his earliest ones where he walks in the room and they're doing spit takes.
Yeah.
And then the guy's talking about things that are like funny and things that aren't funny and like cancer.
Yeah.
Cancer, not funny.
Yeah. He's just so funny. But I put, you know, I think I'm slowly compiling a list of modern masterpieces.
Yeah.
And Tropic Thunder is pretty high up there.
Oh, wow.
But apparently, according to my producer, the last time you were on, we talked about that the entire show.
We did? Okay. That's how long ago Tropic Thunder was. What have you done lately?
Well, I watched it. I watched it again.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. It's the fucking best.
Yeah. I'm so happy that it has a life, you know?
Well, I try to keep things alive, you know, with people.
Yeah.
But it does have a life.
You
kind of get feedback from it.
Yes, I do. Yeah. Which and also a lot of it is in relation to, like, the, you know, cancel culture and, like, you couldn't make that movie today.
Right.
That's, like, a perennial sort of question.
What do you think of that, though? I mean, like when you think of... we'll talk about the other stuff, but like those type of, well, just film comedy in general. I mean, are they even doing it?
I don't think it exists right now.
It's kind of weird, right?
Yeah.
Because no one's willing to take a chance or what? I don't know.
I mean, I think it's just the movie economics right now is that there are the movies that are in theaters are not, you know, are movies that have to seem like they have to make a huge amount of money.
Right.
Like $1 billion. But,
and then comedy had its day. It used to make money.
Yeah, it did.
And
people not going, like... I feel bad that people can't experience the fun of what we used to experience all the time, which was comedies in theaters and people laughing their asses off and just feeling that energy in the theater.
And no more.
It was so exciting.
How did we get them back?
I don't know.
They're hard to land.
I think show business is in a weird place in terms of the just what streaming has done to movies.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm happy that blockbuster movies are working and that people are going to the theaters, but it's hard to, you know, make something that is not a blockbuster now or is not a sequel or is not a genre movie like a horror movie that they can make for
horror movies, that's the thing.
Yeah.
It seems like all the creative, like truly inspired people are going to horror because it's the place with the most freedom.
Yeah, and it's a genre where they can make them for, you know, a budget that would then, you know, they'll get the money back at the theater.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's too bad that, like, the movies that we grew up watching in the theaters, you know, dramas and comedies,
yeah, yeah,
and sort of these mid-budget movies, you know, yeah, that you know, like Dog Day Afternoon, movies like that were, like, mainstream movies.
The best.
Yeah, the best.
That one's crazy. I hosted it at the Cinematheque screening, like, in
yeah, recently.
Yeah, not from last year. They were like, do you want to host a movie? And I'm like, yeah. And my first one was Dog Day.
Oh, so great.
And by coincidence, some woman who's a listener was the assistant editor on it. And she had this story about having to bring the one cut that existed up to a screening room for Lumet and Pacino. And she left it on the ground when she was getting into a cab and it got run over by a bus.
Oh my
the
God.
One print. So this day of panic, of hoping the film wasn't damaged and then not telling them, it all worked out. But what a great fucking story. The
That's
idea
crazy.
that time existed, like you got the one print.
Yeah, the print.
Holy fuck.
I know.
But I wish there was more comedy. I keep thinking, like, the last time I, did you watch that that movie with Nicolas Cage, the dream scenario?
I didn't see it, no.
Oh boy, there's a fart scene in that that's worth the last 10 years of comedy.
Really?
Oh my God.
Okay. I had not heard about that.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's the best. And then when I was watching that, just the laughs of something that simple, I was like, where are these movies? Where's the whole fart movie? Where
I know. I have to believe
and
that
you actually mocked
back.
That in Tropic Thunder.
Fatty's fart too. I mean, I wish I knew, you know, what the answer was, other than I think somebody has to make a comedy that a studio puts in theaters that does well.
And also, like, there, like, a lot of the, I don't know who the truly hilarious people are that have the gravitas to carry a movie.
Well, that's a whole other discussion, I think.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, not having a runway for actors to build a career in movies because that doesn't really exist anymore.
Right. It so they can't, yeah. they don't yeah. have, they can't hold it.
Yeah, because, right. So then it's sort of this catch-22 where the studios want to have a recognizable star in a movie.
Yeah.
So to kind of guarantee that people are going to go, but then there hasn't been any ladder to build those stars. So it's stuck with people like old people.
Old
like
guys,
us who they people know somehow that then they, you know, and that model can't last.
Right,
forever.
Right.
And it's too bad because there's so many talented people who should be in the movies and that should be big movie stars. And
but I guess you're right that the business of movies doesn't exist in the same way at all.
Yeah.
So they've got to find...
It's like they're not willing to take the chances on the movies that will create stars.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so you get plugged in, maybe you know somebody gets plugged into a superhero movie or something like that and then they get a career that way.
But
it's unfortunate because, that's... That there's a dearth of those people.
And, but you don't have, but you're interested.
I mean, it's not like a dearth of like talented actors. It's just like proven actors in movies, you know, that get the chance to carry something.
Well, some people are hilarious that are, you know, they're movie stars that are hilarious that aren't essentially comic actors. And when they do comedy, like if Clooney does a comedy or Matt Damon, you're happy about it.
Right.
But still we're the young guns of the funny stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's also I always feel like that's also bonus comedy. Like, it's always easy to have bonus comedy in something where you're not expecting it to necessarily be funny.
Yeah.
But the humor's added in.
Oh, yeah.
And then you really appreciate it.
Oh, it's the best.
Even like on Severance, I feel like it's so much less pressure because it's not a comedy. It's just.
There's some funny, there's very funny shit in it.
Yeah. But I feel like we're allowed to put that in there because there's no expectation of like, okay, where are the laughs?
Right. And that's a load. Off.
Yes, it's a load off.
But that's interesting. So, but your interest in comedy in terms of projects or directing is limited, if not there at this point, right?
There's an interest. There is. I don't know how to figure it out really right now.
Because Severance, for me, not being totally a sci-fi guy and being impatient.
sounds like the show for you.
No, my girlfriend loved it. I mean, she was like crazy about it. She's got this dream that you could put her dog into the next season. I don't know why.
Oh, really?
She's got this miniature bull terrier that she just thinks should be a star.
Okay.
But no pressure.
All right. Let's have a meet and greet.
Yeah, okay.
Whatever.
Yeah, you can Zoom with the dog. Yeah. But I watched all of it. But for me, and I appreciated it, but like at some point with shows like that, you know, about halfway through, I'm like, all right, let's wrap it up. Where's this going? How long do I got to wait? I can't figure it out.
I understand. I get that.
But I think it was great. It was beautiful. Yeah, yeah, it was funny. It was like, and she said to me, interesting, she said, well, if you've never worked in a job,
right,
it's not going to land the same way. You know,
yeah, but, well, what's interesting to me about it is like I never worked in a cubicle office job ever, too. So like I'm sort of fascinated with that world because I never experienced it. For me, what was interesting about it was I was excited was when I read the pilot, I thought the tone of it was so unique.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of these office comedies.
Okay.
It reminded me of like The Office or Parks and Rec, or it just had this banter.
But it wasn't written as a comedy.
It was written as like a weird, like, I think there were elements of humor. I think he was thinking about, like, what if The Office was in, like, this weird Twilight Zone.
Right.
Where people, like, were going to work and doing their thing, but they didn't know who they were, what they were doing, or why they were there.
Right.
And so, you know, it's a little bit of this sort of like, you know, six characters in search of an author.
Sure, but, sure. Yeah. But that's one of the, it's such a high concept. That's like that, like Charlie Kaufman script where you're just sort of like, what?
Yeah. No, but the basic idea behind it was like, what if you could just shut off your outside life when you go to work? And then when you left work, you don't remember what happened and you just go back to your life. So you don't have to have the drudgery of, you know, 8 hours or 10 hours at work.
Right.
And so that was where it came out of for Dan Erickson.
Yeah.
And then the idea of like, well, how can you really deaden parts of your, you know, of your like, can you deaden pain? Can you mask pain? Can you forget things if you, you know, can you cut
can
them
you turn off your can you sense turn it of off? Self?
Yeah. And then the question is like, well, then what if you have two selves, the one that goes to work and the one that's outside, which is the real one?
Right.
And can we compartmentalize like that? And then the questions in the show through the second season become like, well, who's more important, the innie or the outie?
Right.
And yeah.
So the device of the implant was always there from day
one? Yeah, from the beginning. That was what I thought was really interesting was that it's not really a sci-fi show because the only sci-fi part of it is the chip.
Yeah.
The chip is just like if we believe that there's a chip you can put in your head that could, you know, get triggered and cut off your memory from, you know, the outside world. All the guy's doing is he has a chip in his head and he goes into an elevator.
Yeah.
And he literally just goes down a couple floors.
Gets activated. Yeah.
So there's nothing like magical happening.
So it's not sci-fi because like, come on, they can do that, man. They could do that.
Right, right. Which by the way, they're on their way to being able to do.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Neuralink and all that stuff.
Right.
But that's what was interesting to me. It was like, okay, so this is actually just like a guy going down the elevator, but he just doesn't remember who he is upstairs.
Right.
And then there's also a weird sort of like mystical kind of company, you know,
history
and, you know, ethos that is, you know, very religious.
Secret society kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so who came up with that
story? That was all part of the original script.
Really?
Yeah. And then we kind of developed it out as we, you know, we worked on the episodes to really this company lore, the idea of sort of, you know, like the company being almost a religion, you know? And that goes back to like, you know, like to Amway or you know what I mean? Back in the day.
Even earlier.
Yeah.
You know, like what was the one, the Kellogg's or somebody, the one that started as sort of this health food cult.
Right, right.
And then eventually became a cereal.
Right.
Or whatever. Yeah, I think they were all the early sort of business entrepreneurs were kind of hucksters on some level.
Yeah, and the question of this guy, Keir Egan, who created the company, what his story around the time of the, you know, Civil War.
Yeah.
And a guy who was trying to figure out something that would help you, you know, deaden pain.
But so, you know, building out the secret society or religious cult or the, like, how did that evolve? How many writers were on that thing?
It's like basically a very small group. It was Dan Erickson who created the show. And then we had a couple of other guys, Mark Friedman, the first season, and myself and Dan and Mark spent a lot of time talking about all of it.
Yeah.
And it was all out of Dan's mind.
Right.
But we really wanted there to be like a very, very specific history that these people were taught. Because imagine if you're in this world where you don't know anything else, this corporate theology and ideology becomes everything for these innies because they don't have any other religion or any memory of a life.
That's right. So they're blank slates when they come in.
So in a way, you know, there is a certain amount of cult-like, you know, sort of activity going on.
And how does it feel to, like, you know, have a show where you've got an entire sort of group of, like, Severance nerd Reddit people who are trying to, like, deconstruct or read into it?
Yeah.
But you know the answer.
Right.
And that, you know, like, because I sadly, I know that most of the time when you're writing, you're flying by the seat of your pants, you don't have answers yet. And, you know, you're like still working on the episode that's, you know, two after the one you're shooting.
Yep.
And that no one's sitting there going like, no, the goats are going to, you know.
it's not that on this show because there is a lot that has to be, you know, thought out.
All the way through.
It has to be, but you're right in that the creative process is very messy, and it should be. You know what I mean? The creative process has to allow space to figure stuff out.
Yeah.
But I've never experienced anything like this where I've worked on something where people are so curious. First of all, the people who are fans of the show, which I so appreciate, are watching every little detail.
Yeah.
For some reason, from the first season, they really saw—
Well, it's so sparse. I mean, like everything is infused with meaning
right.
when you know, it is so that the way it's shot.
Right. When very little happens, when something happens, it's very important.
Yeah. You know, from everything, from, you know, the gifts that they get, you know, to the fruit platter, to whatever.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then, like, when you bring goats in, it's over.
Right.
You know, people are going to be wondering about goats for, like, you know,
and
weeks.
The first season, Apple was concerned about the goats.
In what way?
They thought the goats, they were like concerned that we were going to have goats in the show.
Because they just didn't want to deal with animals?
They were like, no, like maybe the goats are too weird. Like, are people going to be able to, like, is that going to be too out there?
And what do you mean? That's the thing?
Well, just that there would be baby goats.
In a room.
Yeah, in a room. And we were like, no, this is like what the show is. And we feel like this, and interestingly, the baby goats did become a real focal point for the first season. But yeah, like it's the audience for the show is paying such close attention. So, you know, that, and by the way, that's like what a great thing. When you make stuff, you hope that people are going to like pay attention. Like how many times have you made something and you go like, I hope the guy's not watching it like on his phone while he's watching the Knicks game and you know, whatever. It's like, how can you get
watching
people
it at all
or watching
or
it at
like,
all?
They're like, where's it on? You know,
for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing. We've all done stuff too, that like you make it and then it kind of just goes into the ether because there's so much stuff out there. So I'm very like aware of like to have an audience that's paying attention and watching is like, that's a
well, the type
huge
of people
thing.
That like that it gravitates or that it resonates with, like for me, I don't know if it's because I'm old or what, but even when, you know, we get the resolution at the end of the season, I'm the guy who's sort of like, I'm not sure I get it.
Right.
And I think that might just be my age. Cause
well, that's what, for me, that's what my wife is for, because she's the one who explains everything to me, too. I've just become my parents.
It happens. Yeah. What are we going to do?
Because I'm like that, too. What's interesting to me also on the show is that people get are focusing on different things. So people get really locked up in like, what is the mystery of what they're doing or why they're doing it? But other people get really into the relationships and like with Mark and Helly and Helena and you know, Gemma, they care about that too. So it's like constantly kind of like trying to like, you know, navigate, you know, all these different aspects of the show that you hope people are, you know, connecting with.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's kind of astounding how much you got in there. And I think that when you can deal with a kind of poetry that is sparse, that it must enable you to, when you decide on an element – and you know it's going to pop because, you know, that's the whole show. It's not complicated in terms of how it's set. So if you do something that's a little cryptic, you know it's going to be loaded.
Exactly.
And it can imply anything. It's like there's a poetry to it.
Yeah, and that's the fun of it too.
Yeah.
Because you don't – and then you don't want to answer people's questions or give them too much feedback on what they're, you know, stipulating or postulating because – you don't want to take away the possibility for them of what it might be for them.
Yeah.
Because even if it might not be that for me, I've seen people write out, you know, theories that are like, oh, yeah, that actually could be something.
Where'd you find Trammell, though? I've never seen him before.
He came in an audition.
What an interesting guy.
Yeah. And it was interesting to see his character develop over the course of two seasons, too.
Yeah.
Because he really has a lot of layers to what's going on in his face too when you watch him work.
Oh, and the dancing and like how much of that stuff was did you give?
That was like, you know, I didn't know he was such a great dancer, but we had this idea to do this, you know, music dance experience, and I said, should we get a choreographer? And he's like, yeah, we could get a choreographer, but I have some ideas. And then he got out and did his thing. He's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
You're like,
yeah, we're good.
The smoothest guy ever.
But and, how did you sort of devise like what was your thinking around the not so much the direction, but in terms of production design and all that stuff, what were you thinking when you decided on? Were you thinking like THX? Were you looking at sci-fi stuff? Were you like
a little bit, but it was like a lot of reference points with our Jeremy Hindle, our production designer, and Jessica Lee Gagne, who's our cinematographer.
Yeah.
We would like just get a lot of photography and just look at like pictures by like guys like Lars Tunbjork.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And Elliot Erwitt even, like stuff like 60s office photography.
Oh, really?
Like that. Yeah. And then design elements from like, you know, like Russia in the 60s and like just weird sort of brutalist stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we put together a book, a lookbook,
yeah,
like a 200-page lookbook that's always growing that Jeremy was in charge of. And we just started to go, yeah, this image. So we knew we had to have this main set where a lot of the show was going to take place. And it was written as sort of an oversized room with four cubicles in the center.
Right.
And a slightly lower ceiling.
But
and
the effect of that, like when you must have looked at the framing that, you're like, oh my God, this is it.
Well,
because it's so bizarre.
But also we thought, okay, if this show is successful and runs for a few seasons, a lot of scenes are going to take place in this room. And that was a little bit daunting to me because I knew that like this set was sort of like the hero set.
Yeah.
And I'd never made a series before. I did Escape at Dannemora. It was a limited series, but I'd never done like an open-ended series.
Yeah, but also like in Dannemora, it's a fucking prison.
It's a prison, right.
So it's
sort of reality. You're just going for
it. Right. Like, you know,
But weirdly, this place is kind of like a prison too.
Of course, but it must be daunting to realize the weight that the actors have to carry. You know, in such a sparse thing, like these characters.
100%. And but even with the set, like the first thing I'm thinking is like, okay, the carpet. What color green is the carpet? Because whatever color green we choose, this is going to be the color of the carpet for like, you know, the next five seasons if the show goes.
Yeah.
So the responsibility of those questions and making those decisions was like, I did think about that a lot.
Yeah.
And then it was like, okay, this set is basically this set. It's kind of cool, low ceiling. It has some really great angles. The ceiling is really interesting. But then at the end of the day, it's the actors. It's all about the actors in the show.
It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, it's the best thing I think that Adam Scott's ever done.
He's great.
I mean, it's like there's so much depth and weirdness and, you know, shifting between things. And, you know, and he's a funny guy.
Yeah.
But like, you know, it really, if he's funny in this, it's only because he's wry.
Right.
About, you know what I mean? But the struggle of that character, he really did a fucking great job.
Yeah. And he was, to me, was always the choice for it because of what he'd done in Parks and Rec and seeing, like, understanding. And I worked with him in MIDI. Like, I knew that he got that sort of office humor rhythm.
Right.
But then I also felt like he had a lot underneath that too.
It's so funny to think about that at the core of this is sort of an office comedy.
Yeah.
Because it does function that way in terms of their dynamic.
Right.
But then all the other layers of things, it's almost like, it's not that it's nothing, but it just kind of gives life to the coldness of the rest of it.
Right. Well, it does become like, it's like a workplace. You know what I mean? It's a workplace, but they're in like maybe in hell. We don't know. That's not, by the way, what it is.
Don't cause trouble with people who are going to be waiting for it. Like, what? How are you doing another season?
That would be like the most obvious thing. They're in hell. We're doing another season.
But isn't it amazing you create this canvas for people to, like, because it's bordering on sci-fi, that they can think anything.
Yes, I've never been in that world before, and it's amazing. It's amazing. And it's really fun. It's fun to be, because then you're like, oh, wow, we actually, if we do this in a way that's deliberate, we can, you know, it can be really entertaining and fun to give people the freedom to have those theories.
Yeah, you know? And Patricia Arquette, like, I mean, you work with her on Dannemora, right. And it was like, she is so intense and such a great actress that you, like, when you cast her, you just knew that that would be the anchor of this kind of.
It was sort of like the role was to me, like, it kind of like I thought like the more sort of like straight ahead casting would have been like someone like Tilda Swinton or something for that role. Because she was like kind of this very like ice cold.
Right.
Boss. Who,
right.
You know. But I also, having just worked with Patricia on Dannemora when we started working on Severance, and she had played like sort of the opposite of that character.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, I could see Patricia as this like kind of cold ice queen who has she has such a weird sense of humor too in real life. Have you ever had her on?
Yeah, years ago.
You know,
ago,
she's just so funny and goofy.
But also she's got that sort of, you know, that kind of like emotional just, you know, a slight emotional instability somewhere in there.
Sure. Yeah.
So like the character who was brought up in the religion of the corporate cult,
right,
then starts breaking away, you know, to be able to play that.
Yes. Yeah.
Where she, like, you know, is betrayed by the corporate cult policy. I mean, like, she's the perfect person to do that.
Yeah. Well, she invests so much into it, you know what I mean? And she is so vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I love her. I love working with her. She's the most incredible person. She's, you know, she really cares about people. She just, you know, and she's just, and then she's just like, she doesn't, she's not precious in any way, and she's willing to take chances.
Yeah.
Because honestly, the first season on the show, we were trying to figure out her character.
Yeah.
I mean, she was trying so many different things.
Yeah.
And I think in my head, I had a, like, an idea that was my preconceived idea of what Ms. Cobell was. And she had a slightly different idea, and I kept on, like, kind of going back, well, maybe it's this or that. And to her credit, she, like, let me kind of be a pain in the butt for a long time with her. Kind of said, maybe try this or that, you know? And I don't think very few actors I would feel comfortable even having that. Like, I would not, like, with Christopher Walken, who I love and is the sweetest guy in the world,
yeah,
I maybe have said two words of direction to him ever.
Sure.
Because he's Chris Walken. And, like, I'll say maybe, like, hey, maybe this time a little slower.
Yeah.
Or, like, I didn't quite hear that last line. Right. That's about it.
That's
because
it.
I don't want to meh. And, by the way, Chris Walken and Patricia Arquette are equally brilliant people.
Sure.
But I have a relationship with – and I know Chris because he worked with my dad back in the 80s. And he's the warmest – I go to his house. And I love him.
Yeah.
But I – when it comes to acting and directing him,
you didn't
like, what am I going to say to Chris Walken?
Well, some directors, like, I've talked to people, like, it was kind of mind-blowing to me when I talked to, I think, Walter Hill. Because I was, like, my perception of what a director does, I'm like, how much do you know, kind of work with the actors? He goes, I don't.
Right.
I hired them because they're going to do the job.
That's what Ridley Scott says,
too. Yeah.
It's like, and it's a very specific attitude that great director, and I can understand that because sometimes I've worked with directors who, like, as an actor, who will come in and start talking, and you're like, well, you're getting in my head. What do you, you know, like, you don't have to necessarily say anything to me if it's working, you know, if it's working.
Right, right, yeah.
Like, you don't have to justify the job by coming in and doing, like, you have to this or that. And I think those directors who have a really healthy sense of themselves in terms of how they work, know that it's like the actors do their thing.
It's about the casting.
Yes, exactly.
You've hired the guy to do a thing.
Yes.
But I mean, but my perception was always like, you know, you're going to work close
right.
with the director and really hammer this out. But in my experience of being on set, it's usually like, maybe not so, you know, you're coming in a little hot.
Right.
Can you turn that down a little bit? And it's, no problem.
It should be whatever is needed.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, to me, that's what the job of the director is you're watching the scene and you're looking at it. And you get the camera set up in hopefully the right place.
Yeah.
And then you watch the rehearsal and then you react to what is working, what's not working.
Right.
If you think an actor is missing something or if you're not believing something.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever it is. And then you have to figure out how to communicate to whoever it is you want to communicate that note.
Yeah.
But sometimes not saying anything is a way of doing it too, because, you know, maybe the next take they won't do that.
Right.
Maybe me saying something is going to get too much in their head.
Right, right.
And this actor seems to want to have space.
Right.
Other actors seem to want to, you know, talk it through.
But I also think, like, what you're saying with Patricia, it's not that you're just saying, like, let's try this or that. It's not like, you know, you're not getting it.
I think with Patricia, because I'd had the experience of Dan Amore and we'd worked together, you know, 30 years ago or whatever on Flirting with Disaster. And I hadn't really seen her a lot since then. And who she is as a person, I feel like she's like a sister or something.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't know, you know how some people you just have that comfortability with?
Yeah.
So I felt from the previous, by the way, I didn't give her a lot of direction when we were doing Dan Amore too, because she came in same way like Robert Downey on Tropic Thunder.
Yeah.
I'm not, this guy came in with his thing and I'm just watching going, oh shit. You know, as an audience, I'm going, that's good. Okay. I like that. So when, it's like if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
So you just, and that's what your job is that, and then to figure out how you can communicate what you want to communicate without making it worse, hopefully.
But it's like you said, it's kind of like there is, there's a theatricality to the thing. That's almost like a play.
Yes.
So, you know, that everything operates as sort of this Beckett-like situation.
Yes. And, for sure.
And so you had a lot of, like, you knew that anything any actor was going to say had to, it was going to resonate.
Right. For sure. And also, like, I love trusting that, not having to, you talk about the pace in the show and stuff like that. It might be a reaction for me from having the years of the test screenings,
yeah,
and the pacing and sort of, you know, doing like, you know, a screening of a comedy.
You've been around a long time.
Yeah, exactly. Back in the day when, you know, we'd do the test screen, the focus group, and you'd sit in the back of the theater and they'd be like, so what'd you think? Any Ben Stiller fans here? And like, yeah.
That's over, huh? You don't have to do that anymore.
Well, on Dan Amore, that was the first thing I ever made that I didn't have to test it.
Yeah.
The first thing I ever directed that
really?
I didn't have to test. And it was so freeing.
Yeah.
And so I was like, wait a minute, I could do this whole scene and I'm just going to let it play out and that's it. I'm not going to see if anybody thinks it's too long or anything like that. And that's what we did. And then we'd send it to the network and they were like, yeah, that's good. Or they'd say, like, this might have been a little, like, maybe you could tighten this up. And that's a whole other thing.
But it's so different that these projects you're doing, even like from the jump from MIDI to Dan Amore to all this stuff. So you just want to try shit.
Yeah. Well, I also want to make stuff that I really want to see, too.
What drew you to Dan Amore?
I wanted to see it.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I loved it. This is like, this reminds me of like, you know, Dog Day Afternoon for some reason.
Sure.
The tone, like it feels like a 70s story.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though it's, you know, whatever, 2015 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And why is that? Oh, well, because they're in prison. And then when I went to visit the prison, I was like, oh, wait a minute. This could be 1975.
Sure.
Because there's no cell phones in here. Nobody's got any technology.
Oh, right,
you're not allowed.
Yeah,
this place looks exactly the same as it did. To communicate with a guy, you got to do a secret note and put a thing. And it's like, oh, yeah, the storytelling. Because, you know, how much of storytelling has been screwed up by cell phones, right?
Everything,
right?
Yeah.
So detective stories, anything. It's like everything. You just like Google it or find it.
So
when you're in prison, all of a sudden you can do like a period piece without it being in the period.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And then it becomes about people.
Yeah. And then it's just about people who are like, how do people react?
Unmediated with no technological mediation.
Yeah. And then like barriers that they have to figure out how to get around, which is, you know, like human nature. It's just like people are going to be people. Guys are going to like girls. Guys are going to like guys. Girls are going to like girls.
Right.
All of it. People are going to be attracted to each other, figure out how to connect.
And then you have Benicio in the middle of it.
Exactly. I mean, wow.
That character was something, huh?
Yeah. And that guy was Richard Matt was a really interesting guy. He was a brilliant, you know, person because he was a great artist. He was really smart, understood the machinations of how to work, to live in a prison society and do. And then when he got outside of it, it all kind of fell apart.
Yeah.
He was much better within that structure.
The real guy?
Yeah, the real guy.
It's
he died, you know, out in the wilderness because I don't think he could handle it.
How did working with that guy?
Benicio?
Yeah. Was that the first time you worked with him?
Yeah.
And did you know him before?
I knew Benicio because we're like same age.
You've been around the
years,
game for a while.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And run into him, you know, I knew Rick Yorn, who's his manager for years.
Yeah.
And it was really quite an experience working with Benicio.
I bet.
It was, I never worked with an actor who, first of all, he had never done a limited series.
Yeah.
It was the first time he ever done anything on television.
Yeah.
And so when we met, his whole thing was like, the thing was not written all the way through when we met.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, how can I play it if I don't know what the ending is?
Yeah.
And which was interesting because as a guy who'd done movies, he'd have a script. He'd read a script.
Sure.
And for his process as an actor, he has to know what the arc of the character is and where he's going.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, that's okay. I get that. We know what the general ending is because it's a true story.
Yeah.
But the scripts don't exist yet. And it was a series of meetings with him, a bunch of meetings where I'd come out here to meet with him and talk to him about it and tell him the script, how it was developing, talk about episodes.
This is before he agreed
before
to
he
it?
Before he agreed to it.
And then you finally, you know, you got
and
closure.
Then,
you...
then we got, then he agreed. I think in the beginning, he was always daunted by the fact that it was so much. Which, again, totally understandable as a movie actor.
Like,
you know, two-hour movie.
Right.
This is going to be like a 7 or 8 hour thing.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know? And we just developed a sort of trust with each other talking about it where I said, look, I totally get it. This is the first time I've done something like this too.
Sure.
But we both knew that we'd been around, but we didn't really know each other. So it was like, do you want to jump in together on this? And I remember we had this conversation. We said, you know what, we chip away at it. We just chip away at it scene by scene.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we connected, where it's just like, yeah, we're going to chip away at it scene by scene and try to make every scene as good as possible. And that's what I got working with him, was that every scene he approached, he wanted to make as interesting and as layered and as good as he could.
So
every scene
has an arc.
Right.
Every scene has its own arc.
Right.
Right? So once you develop the character... You know, he's just playing this, like, I imagine you look at the scene and you can kind of see where that goes, even if it's in 2 minutes.
Right, right. Which is, you know, analyzing the scene, it's, like really looking at it, as opposed to just saying like, oh, I go here, I go there. You know, it, he was thinking about, and then also like literally thinking like, what can I do here that's going to somehow illuminate who this character is and show
and,
something.
And you can't take his eyes, you can't take your eyes off him.
Right.
The character was, it was crazy.
Yeah, he's seductive and he's scary.
But
and
it's an interesting thing with those actors, because I have this like other thing with Malkovich too, where it's like there's the movie and then there's the one they're in.
Yeah, totally. 100%.
But it's great. It's worth it. You know, it's worth it. But it's definitely like... This guy's on another level.
Yeah. And but, and it's every scene is like he's coming and go like, what if I, you know, was like standing on my head at the beginning of this scene? Like, whoa.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Why? Well, I don't know. Like, you know, he's trying to stay in shape.
And you have to be like, try it.
Well, sometimes, sometimes it would be like that. And sometimes it'd be like, I don't know about that. And then we'd have the discussion about it. There was, you know, there was one choice he made where, you know, he says to her, like, don't tell anybody. And he like does this crazy voice when she finds out that they're going to try to escape.
Yeah.
And he did this huge thing.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting.
Right.
And I was like, wow, that's a choice that like I did not see coming. And he was like, yeah. And I think, you know, I'm trying to scare her into not telling anybody. And I was like, all right, great. That was great. Should we try another? And you want to try like maybe one that's like a little smaller or like a... He's like, no, I think I'm good. I'm kind of married to that one. I'm like, okay. All right. And my director...
He scared you.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Definitely. Like, I mean, like, he's, you know, he has a presence.
Yeah.
And that tension was actually, like, a very real thing on set. But, like, you know what? That was good for me to learn as a director, too.
Yeah.
Like, when to, like, go... Like, do I need to assert myself here as a director?
Right.
And, like, show that I'm the director? Like, how much is it, my ego as a director that I have to... You know, because you do get into that thing.
There's always
like,
a risk in that, right? Because, like, you do that once... And you risk the possibility of an entire cast going like, oh, fuck.
Right. Or the relationship that we have, Benicio and I, like, if you don't want it to become tenuous, but also, like, you don't ever want to not say something that you feel.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, on that one in particular, I saw that, like, he really wanted to do that. And it probably was, I think, ultimately, like, that he didn't necessarily trust that if he gave me another choice.
Yeah.
That I might use the other choice in the edit.
Right. Well, that's...
Which is how you, as an actor, sometimes you protect yourself, right?
Yeah.
If you don't give them a choice.
If you're on top of it. Yeah.
So I felt like the only thing I thought there was like, oh, maybe I wish he trusted more that, you know?
To have this other option.
Like, but I also totally understood that because he had never worked with me before necessarily. And then when he saw the first... when he saw the cut of the first episode...
Yeah.
He was like, oh, man, I really, that's great. It was the first time I feel like he was like, oh, I get it, you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, really?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But
that's funny.
Yeah. But I mean,
how's he going to know until you see how it comes together?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Like Owen doesn't watch anything he's ever been in.
Ever.
It's crazy.
I know. It's so crazy.
You know, and because like, it's like, I remember like just after the premiere, like he showed up for the press and then him and Luke went and got something to eat.
Right.
And they come back and I saw him at the party. And, you know, I asked him why, and he said, because, like, you know, that little fight scene we did, it was like, I remember that being the greatest scene ever. Why would I want to fuck with that? Like, you know, why would I want to see what it's become?
Right.
But then when I went up to him after the premiere and I was at the party, I said, I think it really works, dude. I think you and I, it works. He's like, really? You're like,
Of course.
Man, but he, you know, he still needed that.
Of course.
It's so funny.
I mean, it's a really interesting thing because I obviously know Owen forever.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to imagine like all the stuff that we did over the years that he's never seen.
So funny too, right?
Yeah. Because he's done some like really amazing, funny stuff.
No, it was great to work with him. He's an interesting guy. And he's just one of those guys where you're like, all right, well, I guess... yeah, well, you know, you're a mysterious guy.
Did you ever have him on the podcast?
No, I don't think he'd do it.
Really?
No, I mean, like, I don't...
So interesting. I was thinking about that when I was coming over, like, did you have him on? Because he is an interesting guy.
Totally.
He's got so much going on, and he is a mystery, too.
He's a real...
And I've known him for, whatever, 30 years.
Well, he's got very poetic sensibility. He's very smart, and he, like, really takes things in and engages with it. But you do get the sense it's sort of like, well, you know, I'm not going to poke around in there.
Right. Yeah.
You're good.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're good, and that's good.
And he's... He loves, you know, he loves to read. I think he loves movies.
Yeah.
He loves biographies.
Oh, yeah. He locks into movies. Like, you know, he's really good with that. Like, you know, certain lines and stuff. We got a lot of laughs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doing, just talking about movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's great.
That's my memory of working with Owen, and we're about to work together again because we're going to do another Meet the Parents, and it's been a while since I worked with him, is the laughs with him on set. Hanging out.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Us, like we did in the last, like, Little Fockers, I think we had a scene with Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
And it was just a funny energy with, like, me and Owen and Harvey Keitel. Harvey, I know from when I was a kid, because he worked with my dad and people like that.
Yeah,
But Harvey Keitel and De Niro, these guys are, like, you know, these screen legend kind of guys. And, like, I think Owen and I were feeling very insecure doing a scene with Harvey.
Yeah.
Harvey was, like, in Mean Streets or something. Yeah. And we're, like, and he kind of was, like, looking at us like we were two wise guys or something. Yeah, yeah. Like, what do you two guys got going on here? And I like moments like that with Owen over the years that just really.
And he's good. He likes to laugh.
Yeah, he loves to laugh. Yeah, he'll like call me up and like, he also has the craziest memory. You know that too,
right? Yeah, yeah.
He'll remember stuff that I told him about my childhood like 25 years ago. That he'll like go, hey, and he'll just literally call me up and goes, yeah, I was just thinking about that time when, you know, you said your dad picked you up from camp when you were homesick and then you told him to leave when you met that girl. And he was just making me laugh.
Well, I think that like, I think
worst
that's
Owen Wilson impression, by the way.
Yeah. Some people can really do him. Spade can do him.
Oh, can he?
Yeah. But there's something, I think when something has meaning to him, when he sees it or reads it or something, it stays in there.
Yes.
And it becomes a point of reference, emotional point of reference.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of why he's also kind of a great natural actor.
Yeah.
Is that like he does find meaning.
Yes.
Because it's all very immediate. It's like a poetry to it.
And his performance in Bottle Rocket, for me, is like one of the most special
the
comedic performances.
And then when I watch him on the show, because like, you know, when you're acting across from somebody, you don't know what they're doing really, because you're just in, you know, you don't know how it's going to read.
Right.
Because you're just in the scene.
Right.
And then he's just got all this like crazy natural timing. And it's like, you know, you're watching, I'm like, I didn't even notice that he was doing all that. And I'm sitting here like, you know.
Yeah, of
course. It's kind of crazy. All right, so let's just lay out the entire next season of Severance.
Okay. Well, what do you care?
I watch it. I'm
a
in.
A lot. It's going to be very slow.
All goats.
Not as much going to happen. And then all of a sudden, something will happen.
I got a lot of laughs, goats. And I was always interested. Yeah. The only, and I didn't mean to diminish it in any way.
No, I find it refreshing to talk to someone who wants to talk about
impatient.
What their feeling is for real about it.
It's just, it's a narrative impatience.
Right.
It's not anything else.
And by the
else.
Way, that's the constant for me when we're making it, is my concern is people like you are, you know, going, come on, what's good? But I do go back to Dan Amore for me, like, just I feel like you establish from the beginning, you say, this is what the pace is going to be.
Yeah.
And then we can mess around with it within it. And you just have to trust that. And hopefully that enough people will, you know, be able to.
Well, yeah, no, it builds up and it definitely delivers.
Yeah.
But I can't even watch for me, the enjoyment of suspense is very limited.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't get a kick out of, like, what's going to happen? You know, like, I did that. Like, there's nowhere in my life that's a fucking enjoyable experience.
You don't need that in your life.
No. I have it just like, I have it a half hour before you come over. I'm like, God, what the fuck
am I going to talk about for an hour and a half?
But you know what I mean? Like, my life is so consumed with dread and panic.
Right.
It's not something I'm looking for entertainment.
I understand. I totally get that. I guess I can put my dread and panic of my life into my work. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
sort of like go, okay, I'm just going to experience it.
Well, yeah, but
making.
It must be like a Zen exercise almost.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's interesting because like having edited all these episodes, it becomes like, you know, like it has its own language.
That's and then, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And there's... then you, but I do, I mean, there's the challenges of like, how do we build this thing to a head?
Well, so how much do you know? Because this is like the one thing I know from doing the type of TV I've done and then like seeing like what seems like fully formed visions that like but most of the time you're still writing when you're doing the show, like this idea that like it's a rare person that's got the whole thing mapped out.
I've never had an experience like this where people care so much about also about the process or like are very curious like how much do you know. Do you know the ending?
Yeah.
What is, you know, like, because there's this institutional memory of like, we've been burned before by shows that are these mysteries that are leading to something, and then we feel like they didn't.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I really have felt that a lot with this show, where people like go, well, I hope it better have a good ending, otherwise the whole thing will not have been worth it.
But also, the ending in a show like this, it, you know, has to have a certain element of vagueness,
right,
in order to propel the next, you know, unfolding.
Right. Like, well, what did you think of the ending of The Sopranos?
I was fine. Right. You know, I'd been through enough.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, what do you want?
But, like, the ending where it cuts to black and we don't know what happened.
Yeah, I know, but like, with a show like that, I mean, it's like, you've seen these guys do everything. They've right. killed everybody in every different way.
Right.
I mean, how are you going to beat whatever's happened? Right. The idea.
That's what I think, too. I like that ending.
Me, too.
I think,
I have no problem.
Also, like, I'm still thinking about it 10 years later. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't know, it hit me on some level.
Yeah.
So, like, you have to be willing to make a choice sometimes that is going to, like, leave some people feeling frustrated.
But actually, with that one, it was ultimately the it followed the core of the show was it was humanized.
Yes, yes. By the way, I think that's what every show is about.
Yeah.
Ultimately. That
yeah.
people get connected to the characters.
Yeah, and that, like, you know, well, they just had dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, exactly. So the guy walking towards him didn't shoot him.
Right.
Well, who's that on? That's on you. You know, maybe you should.
Maybe he shoots him 10 seconds later.
Yeah, but.
Let's restart the Sopranos. Ben Stiller starts the Sopranos controversy again.
Yeah, I was fine with it. I talked to you know.
I just thought
Chase
it was.
About it.
There's something about it to me that was like very intrigued. Like it hit me.
But you know, anyone is disappointed with an ending of a series that went on that long and went through that much, they can go fuck themselves.
Right. Exactly. It's or like, is going to retroactively judge the show based on how they landed the plane.
What do you want?
Yes.
It's like whatever.
But I understand, you know, look, this is all spoken from people who are the stress of making these things, right?
Yeah.
Because ultimately you want the audience to be happy, right? But you can only make when you're making a show or you're writing a show or editing or directing, whatever, all you can do is try to satisfy for you what you think feels right.
But I think that the poetry of what this show is that there is sort of this kind of, I don't know if the word cryptic, but, you know, there is a mystery there that doesn't really have a clean resolution.
Right, right. But you want to feel at the end of the whole thing.
Yeah, that something has happened.
Right, exactly.
Sure,
that
sure.
this was somehow, you know, that it doesn't in some way feel like, oh, they copped out or something like
right,
that.
Right, right, yeah.
And that comes from understanding where you're going. But I will say, and I think I said it earlier, it's like it's a messy process. Creativity
sure.
is messy.
Yeah.
So yeah, it has to be. And you have to allow room for discovery within what you're doing.
But the benefit of this is that, like with a lot of shows, procedurals or whatever, not a show like this, is that when you have a, like, you know, when you're trying to figure out the puzzle.
Yeah.
I mean, the big crime of those shows is all of a sudden something in the last episode or the last two episodes is inserted into this puzzle you've been trying to figure out for the entire season. And you're like, what the fuck?
Right. But
there was no way to figure this out.
Right. You
ever.
Didn't get, right. You didn't. Right. You sort of cheated.
You didn't have all
something.
The information,
yeah,
but
yeah,
you guys
yeah.
didn't do that.
No. And it's very important, I think, that you honor that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You don't like go back and go, well, we figured out this thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I will always say you have to have room to discover stuff within these.
Sure.
You know,
well, right. So then that's the creative process.
Yeah,
and that's
exactly.
the excitement of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's the fun of it.
Yeah. Exactly. So, but when at the end, did you like picture at the end of both seasons that this could be the end and it has to be enough?
No.
Okay, you were always like, we're going to keep going.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if they fuck us, it's on them.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
You can't not do that. You know, even in the first season, when like we're sort of like, he's, who, you know, it's like, okay. We have to have another season of the show.
Right.
And we felt like even if Apple is not going to pick it up, then the people are going to be upset. So, like, let's leave a cliffhanger so they hopefully have to pick it up.
Yeah, it's good that you're in that situation because they'll just blame Apple.
Yeah. Right, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, we wanted to make sure that they had that pressure.
But do you have an arc laid out for the next one?
Yes, yeah.
You did.
And that's also, like, that's why I'm out here right now is, we're writing and sort of really figuring out exactly the cadence of the show, how often it comes on, you know, the air is 3 years between two seasons, which is too long.
Too long.
So we're figuring out how to do it so that, you know, doesn't happen again for the life of the show.
So are you going to go back up to Canada?
We don't know. We do it all in New York.
Oh.
It's all New York.
This season or always?
Always.
Didn't you shoot somewhere up in
Newfoundland?
We
shot up in Newfoundland for one episode.
Oh, one
episode. Yeah,
just
this
one
episode where Patricia's character goes back to her
The Jerry episode.
Yeah, the Jerry.
Oh, it's all in New York.
Yeah.
Well, that's
it's
easier,
like mostly in the Bronx.
It?
Well, we had the stage in the Bronx for the first two seasons. So I got very familiar. For 5 years. I've been working on 5 years.
Yeah. That's crazy, man.
Yeah. It's so weird. 19 episodes,
You're
five
so
years.
Lucky that it's satisfying.
Well, it kind of pulled me in. And then the first season, we had COVID. So we shot in the height of COVID.
Yeah.
Which was crazy. Yeah. And then the second season, we had the writer's strike.
Yeah.
So that stopped us in the middle. And I kept editing during the writer's strike because I was a non-writing executive producer.
Yeah.
And so I've been working on the show straight through.
And that's, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like that's the difference between like whatever talent I have or may have for this kind of thing. The idea that like, okay, we're going to do this movie could take 7 years.
Right.
Oh my God. I don't know.
And I'm the most impatient person. And I think this process has taught me like to be somewhere where you're shooting a show and you're like, okay, we're on the set, we're shooting season two. We didn't know it was going to be 3 years before.
Yeah, sure.
But it was a good chance it was going to be at least 2 years. I was like, we're shooting a scene now, guys, that will not be seen for 2 years.
Oh, my God. That's crazy.
And by the way, you finish editing the scene because you can edit it like 2 weeks later.
Sure. And then it just sits
there. It's there. It's like, okay, that's good. But, you know, we got to do the other 9 episodes.
Yeah.
And because of the way streaming works with these, you know, with Apple and these streamers, you have to deliver. You deliver everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it was a show that was a sitcom or whatever, you'd be making the show and 6 weeks later it's on the air.
Yeah.
You know, and you're making the next one. Yeah. This one, it's like even if you finish the first, you know, 3 episodes, it doesn't matter. Those 3 episodes are not going to be delivered or they're not going to be in any way, you know, sent out to the world for a long, long time.
Yeah. So. And so do you have time to do anything else? Are you acting? Are you going to do?
I act. So really during the strike, I acted in this little movie, this little Hulu movie called Nutcrackers that David Gordon Green directed.
Yeah,
that's the only thing I've acted in.
Do you miss that?
And I kind of miss it, but I'm excited to do the Meet the Parents one with Owen.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because it's fun. Because I haven't done that for a long time.
Funny stuff.
And it's also a little bit challenging in a way. Because I feel like that thing.
You've grown.
Like, well, no, just because I haven't done it. Like I feel like a little bit.
Yeah.
Nervous.
Sure. It comes back, right?
Yeah, it does come back.
Who's directing that?
John Hamburg.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So
and he did one. He did some of the Stick episodes.
Yeah, and he did.
Great guy.
We worked together, and he's great. Great comedy director.
Yeah, he is. Yeah,
but it's interesting. I love directing. I'm really happy not having to worry about putting my face
or sitting in a trailer,
or like you talk about looking in the mirror. It's like, you know, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
So or sitting in a trailer. I was talking to Rogan about that too. Like how it can be sometimes like kind of boring,
dude.
You know? Right?
It's the fucking worst part of it.
Yeah. And what do you do when you're working? Like, do you write? Do you go, like, when you have downtime?
I can't do that. No, I look at food. You circle crafty every hour or so. And then you sit in your trailer and eventually you get to the point where you're like, what could they be doing?
Right.
What are they doing?
Right.
So that's my experience.
Yeah.
But no, the last one on Stick, I was like, I was lucky. Because this is like me in acting all the time where I'm not sure I like it because the waiting doesn't justify. You know, I need the acting part to justify the waiting.
Right.
But somehow I figured out how to hook the Samsung TV in the trailer up to my phone, and I could get the Criterion Channel and my Netflix and everything. So I'm like, fuck, I'll watch The Godfather again.
Right.
Yeah, you
know, right.
I'm going to watch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood again, Tropic Thunder.
And how does that work with your acting process? And I'm not saying that facetiously, but like, you know, seriously, like, because I find that kind of like, okay, I'm watching The Godfather, I get into it, and then there's like, hey,
5 minutes.
5 minutes, right? And it's like, oh shit. What am I? Wait a minute. My mother just died. Okay.
Well, that's true. Maybe I'm not as committed as I
No, I don't know. I find it challenging too. Like, I don't know how to, like, I.
Well, yeah. I think like for a day's scene, you know, you look at it, like, out here, here's what you got to do. Right. So and then you kind of lay out your choices. You get to the emotional zone. I'm not. There's a heaviness to this character that I can live in and still watch The Godfather.
Right. Right.
You know, but there were like when I shot I was the lead in this indie movie that Rob Burnett did. And that was the biggest thing I've ever done. But like when you're that.
But you're in every scene, right?
Yeah. So you don't you're not watching downtime. Anything.
Which is much, in a way, it's much easier to do it that way.
It's better.
Yeah, it's better. It's because it's the same thing like, you know, when you're starting out and you get like, or a day on a movie or something like that.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you got to come in and do your thing. And everybody's like super relaxed and they've been doing it. And all of a sudden you're in front of a camera. It's like, it's not a comfortable situation.
Well, that's what happened on fucking. That was the funniest thing. Todd Phillips let me be in the first Joker.
Right.
I was De Niro. I was the producer on the TV show that De Niro was. And I'm just doing these few lines. And this is a whole movie, but all I'm like ready.
Yeah.
And it was that moment where we do a walk and talk that didn't even make the movie. And I meet De Niro and that's a big deal. I don't know fucking, I never met him before and trying to connect. And we did, which is not easy.
Not easy. No. But God love him. He's the best. But, you know, it's Robert De Niro.
It's kind of amazing when you watch actors, like I said with Owen, it's like I'm watching him do these takes, you know, for the show. He's the host of that show.
Yeah.
And I'm just watching him go over and over again. He doesn't have all his lines. I'm like, oh, boy, this is going to be a problem. And then you watch the thing. And you're like, he knew exactly what he was doing. Like there was never.
Oh, my God.
I've seen that. I've seen that before, too.
It's crazy.
When you see like a brilliant actor. Their process sometimes.
Yeah. You're like,
and
oh.
You're, yeah, and you're like, oh, wow, he really did. Wait, I don't know. I've seen that where it's like, this take, I don't know, that take. Yeah, yeah. And then all of a sudden it's like, the next take, and the take locks in. Yeah. I've seen that with Tom Cruise, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah. Okay,
because that person, because he understands that he has to get to somewhere, and then he knows he only needs one take. And then when he finds that take,
it's the best.
It's insane. Yeah. But they're not worried about how they get there, or because they know the process. Yeah. That's what a film actor knows.
Yeah.
They know that. That's what I love about movies. As opposed to doing like the Oscars thing, you can do it 10 times until you get it
right
the way you feel is right.
But there was my scene though. I talked to Todd and I meet De Niro, and then it's just sort of like, all right, let's do one. And I'm like, okay. So it's this walk and talk, and I'm like, rah, 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 you know, I'm like going at it. And then he's cut, and I go back to my chair, and De Niro's across the way at his chair. And I just see De Niro get up and walk over to Todd and then walk back to his seat, and then Todd comes up.
He had a note?
He walks up to me, and he goes, you're coming in a little hot. You remember, like, De Niro's your boss. I'm like, yeah, okay, hey, yeah, I got it. Don't, yeah, good. But because I'm in, I know I'm just this two-line guy, and De Niro's not going to remember me. He's worked with a million two-line guys.
Right.
But then all of a sudden you're going like, oh, I already fucked it up.
Right.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, but then you just kind of pull it together.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how much I enjoy that aspect of it as opposed to coming to a set as a director. You never have to get in front of the camera. It's a different part of your brain in a way.
Yeah.
The thing I do feel like you have to do is you have to somehow try to empathize with the actors.
Yeah, I kind of learned that with Lynn, my the late Lynn Shelton. I mean, she was all about that.
And it's really
and like some people just have that weird empathy thing. But if you're like a self-absorbed, anxious fucking mess all the time, it's something you have to work on.
Yes, but it's something I never even thought. It's funny that she did that because that is, I think, something that nobody tells you to do.
Right.
I thought about it when I was doing Dan and Moore, like, okay, here I am. I'm an actor. I'm looking at these guys who are these amazing actors. How can I connect with them somehow in the scene? They don't need me to connect them, but how do I connect so that I feel like I'm the most connected to the scene to figure out how it should be?
Right.
And I realized, like, for me, it's like, oh, maybe I'm just going to try to empathize with the situation that they're in.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know if that makes
sense.
Did it
work?
Well, it worked for me in that it just made me feel a little bit more connected to the choices that I was making.
And you knew as an actor the situation they were in.
Yeah, I knew as an actor. And also empathize with the fact that I didn't have to be them in that situation, if that makes sense, because it's real. I had so much more of an appreciation for how hard it is.
Yeah, you didn't go cut and go like, hey, guys, I'm so glad I'm not doing
what you're doing. Right. But I felt like somehow, like psychically, if I could sort of put myself in there with them, for me, I would be more connected to the movie.
That's great. Yeah, yeah, that's, I mean, that's like that, like as a director, you
but know. But that's interesting that she just instinctually knew that because she was an actress?
Though? Yeah, she was.
So she had that. That's the thing, that understanding as an actor to empathize.
Yeah, and also I think it's like something I should have realized that I didn't until I talked to Pacino, which was fortuitous because I talked to him just as I was starting that movie, that, you know, artists, the job of an actor is the job of an actor. But the art of an actor, like, you know, Pacino, I didn't know him. And, you know, you make assumptions about people from seeing their work your whole life. But he's a neurotic guy. He's a shy, neurotic guy. And the whole thing for him has been about pursuing the truth of a role, of a scene, of a moment. And that's really it. I mean, that is the art of it. So I think if you're keyed into that and that's what you're looking for and you have an innate sense of what that is, that's an empathy thing.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And I think that sometimes can get lost on a set, you know, when people
sure.
just because it's not a place where that's unless the director
right.
sets that table and says, okay, you know, in whatever way.
And also holds
space.
Back the forces that, you know, money or we don't have time.
Yes.
Or all, you got
like how many times as a director I've felt like, oh, shit, I got like, you know,
right.
10 minutes to get the shot.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go up to, you know, whoever yeah. and say like, hey, I got to get the yeah. shot in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the last thing I want to do.
Yeah.
So there's so many things that are going on that you just want to shield everybody else from. And then it's just sort of like you want to have this exploratory space where there isn't pressure, but it is in a situation that there is always
yeah, sure,
pressure.
Sure. But sometimes you got two actors like, is this a martini? Are we done?
Right. Right. Oh, yeah. For sure. Well, yeah.
This is yes, this
Owen.
yeah. You guys are going to have fun. All right, man. Well, and your health is good?
My health, yeah. As I call, my health is good. I'm 10 years past my prostate cancer.
Well, how'd you not catch that?
I caught it because my doctor gave me a PSA test.
Oh, so like the right way. So
yeah,
you went in for
the
checkup.
I had it at 47, yeah. 48, my yeah. PSA started going up. And the national guidelines are like at 50, you get your, it's a blood test.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
But my doctor just started giving it to me at like 46, 47,
yeah.
thankfully.
Yeah.
And he looked at it, he monitored it for like a couple, like a year or two, and he saw a jump and he said, hey, maybe you should get it checked out.
That's good, because that's a treatable thing. If you get checked
yeah,
out.
But a lot of people, you know.
They miss it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's what President Biden
is dealing with right
well,
now.
Well, he's old.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, yeah. The thing is, a lot of people get diagnosed with prostate cancer at a certain age where they don't do anything about it anyway because it won't grow past their natural lifespan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So,
well, you just got to get those
tests. It's
when
tests. You get it. It's when you're younger and you get it. You just got to get the PSA
yeah,
test.
Yeah, yeah. And you do it every year. Get the colonoscopy when you're supposed to,
yes,
all that stuff.
And by the way, yeah, I mean, not to talk yeah. colonoscopy, but like, you know, the last time I did that, my doctor explained it to me in a way, because I don't know about you, but like, I don't like going in for tests and things like that. I don't want to. There are people I know who get like every year the whole.
How about
like,
those people, the full body scan?
Full body scan.
I can't do it.
Yeah, right. Because you're scared of what you're going to
sure.
find. Yeah.
I had the calcium, you know, the heart, you know, plaque test.
Right.
Like 8 or 9 years ago. And I'm like, all right, well, that didn't.
No, I did that too. A CAT scan? CAT scan?
Yeah, where they can see how much plaque
yes,
you have.
Yes, plaque, yeah.
I didn't like that.
Because you didn't want to know that the plaque, was how much.
Well, I kind of wanted to know because I don't want to clog up.
But you should, right? You should
do
that.
No, of course.
Yeah. And the thing is, when you, like, with the colonoscopy thing, it's like the guy explained to me, he's like, hey, if you do this every whatever.
8 years or whatever.
Yeah.
Six.
They can find polyps,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That they eventually turn cancerous, but they can find them and take them out
yeah.
before they do that.
Yeah.
So in a way, if you
just do it
because you'll be preventing it.
Yeah, of course.
And my fear was like, oh, they're going to do it and they're going to find out like I have, you know,
no, it's all should be preventative.
Yeah.
You know, like, but now they, like, it's so funny because I don't know, someone told me that they can do the PSA test has gotten, you know, specific enough to where they don't have to do the actual finger in the ass.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But there's part of me that's sort of like, go ahead and do the finger.
Just double check
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just make sure it's, you know, feels firm or whatever. No, I don't like it. I'm just saying, you know.
Sure. You want a little physical contact just to,
make sure that we're connecting here.
Yeah, well, no, so that's all good.
Oh, good. Yeah, all right, grateful. Man. Well, great work.
Thanks, man. I mean, I'm so happy I get to be on the podcast before it goes away.
Yeah,
because you're like the OG guy.
Yeah,
you're like,
yeah.
How's it been?
It's been good. You know, it's a heavy decision.
16 years.
But there's this idea now in the media landscape we live in where people just can't understand that. Like, why would you stop?
Right.
I mean, because And we did it.
Yeah.
You know, like, what, you want to end up just being like, is that guy still doing it? You know,
yeah.
Like, just go. You know, we did all right. We talked to everybody twice.
Right. Right. How many people you had on twice?
Not that many.
I feel very honored to.
Yeah, not that many. Yeah. And we generally didn't do it at all.
But you sort of created a genre.
Yes, so I did.
You really did.
And I feel proud of it.
Yeah.
I don't know what my life is going to be like without it because it is pretty labor intensive. And, you know, there's going to be a void there.
Yeah.
That, you know, I'm going to look at as, you know, a world of possibility.
Sure.
As opposed to like, fuck.
Podcasts are so fascinating to me.
Mm.
I mean, because I feel like they fill this void now that comes from talking about, like, when I was working on the movie about my folks and looking at these 70s talk shows,
yeah.
People talked about real stuff.
Sure.
I think podcasts have filled that void where people get real conversation.
Yeah, a lot of times.
Because talk shows now are just, you know,
no, it's just
pre-packaged,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, they're
lightness.
Just, I'll keep the beats viral,
yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, no, I think some top podcasts are like that, but there's also, like, I think there's, like, 20% of that and then about 80%, you know, mediocre drive time afternoon radio.
Right. And it's also, like, gotten very segmented, hasn't it, in terms of who the audience is.
Sure,
for
tribalized.
Yeah.
Well, that's a bigger conversation.
Oh, my God, right?
Yeah, there's some, yeah. On some level, like I said this, I think in the last, when I announced the ending, it's like I was at the beginning of this amazing new medium, but I also feel like I unleashed some sort of evil on the world, you know,
yeah.
The possibilities of it.
Who would have thought that it became such an important part of the political landscape?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Important's a diplomatic word.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I would go with destructive.
Right, sure.
For the most part, but another day, Ben, another
yeah.
day.
No, it's so complicated and interesting, and I definitely don't want to talk about it here.
Good seeing you, man.
All right, man, you too.
There you go, me and Ben Stiller. Again, he's up for Emmys as the producer and director of Severance. You can watch both seasons on Apple TV Plus. Hang out for a minute, folks.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Hey, if you want more discussion about Ben's work, Brendan and Chris are covering Tropic Thunder on the Full Marin bonus feed. It's a two-parter that continues this week.
As this music swells and you see this shot and then you get another chopper shot above this chopper, like yeah. This is before there were drones. Like that, you to do a shot that high in the sky, you needed a helicopter. So it's like a helicopter above a helicopter. And I'm just sitting there watching this going like, this is good filmmaking.
Yes.
Like they're making this. It's like one of the reasons the movie is so successful is that they legit made the movie their parody.
Right. Right.
Like with all the this movie cost over $90 million. Like that's a lot for a comedy.
But you know what?
Like
it looks great.
Everything looks great. Even when they're just like at a river.
Yes.
I'm like, man, they got a great river here. Like I know they're not they're not in Vietnam. They're in Kauai, right?
Yes,
they filmed all this in Hawaii.
Yeah.
But it still looks great. Like they did all the right location scouting and everything. Like Stiller does not get enough credit, which I think he gets now because he makes Severance and everybody thinks he's a good director for real. He did not get enough credit with this movie for being a good director.
That's on the latest episode of The Friday Show for Full Marin subscribers. To sign up and get bonus episodes twice a week, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's some Johnny Thunders. Boomer lives. Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere.